21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Hey, by the way, you were just listening to Bob Darlington, a good friend of mine, called Different Time. It sure is a different time. In some ways it is. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus, our executive producer, research assistant Laura Kortner, and our engineer tonight is Matt Costantini. Well, we have biases on 21st Century Radio, and we don't hide them. Here are our rules and regulations, or R&R. Human beings are not machines. We have an immortal component which is wiser than, well, just any IQ you've ever recorded. We are not alone in the universe. Never have been. We live with visible and invisible beings inside and outside our physical bodies. And, of course, what we do to the Earth, we do to ourselves, and you know what the hell we've done to planet Earth, and you got about half of the people not even realizing in this country that we done it. You're going to be a little bit surprised, huh? Well, we did our first show on Roswell nearly a quarter of a century ago with Dr. Kevin Randall, who has joined us on numerous occasions. Tonight, our entire show is focused on the book Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson, co-authored by Thomas J. Carey and Donald R. Schmidt, both of whom have joined us before on 21st Century Radio. Thomas J. Carey holds a master's degree in anthropology and is an Air Force veteran who held a top secret security clearance. He has spent the last 22 years investigating the Roswell incident and has published more than 35 articles about it. He has also appeared as a guest on many radio and TV shows and contributed to a number of Roswell-related documentations. Tom and his wife, Doreen, reside in Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Tom, or should I call you Thomas?
Tom is good enough, Bob, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I think it's been about
7 years.
6 years.
Oh, 6 years.
Since I've been on.
That's correct. You're right. You have just won a free trip to Bermuda and a carton of Cokes, or would you like a carton of beer or something? One of those two.
Oh, my goodness. Time flies. And this coming February, it will be 23 years that I've spent solely on this case. You know, as far as my research is concerned,
so many books were published in this particular area, but I don't think any of them are as anywhere near as important as this one, Thomas.
Inside the Real Area 51?
That's correct. That's right, Tom.
Well, Bob, the reason that we did this book was that all of your Roswell books, you know, the credible ones, the ones published by researchers, all of them sort of leave off or end when the material and the bodies are delivered to or transported to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, including our own book, Witness to Roswell.
That's right.
You know, we say, oh, it was delivered to Wright-Patterson, end of story. Well, certainly that's not the end of the story, so we wanted to pick up the trail after the material and the bodies were delivered to Wright-Patterson in 1947. And that's what we did. And we called it Inside the Real Area 51 for a certain reason, that being that if you ask anybody about Roswell, oh, they'll say, oh, is that's that UFO crash that happened a long time ago? And they're right. They have an idea what Roswell was. And if you ask them, do you ever hear of Area 51? Oh, yeah, yeah, that's where the aliens are stored.
Yeah.
Well, the original Area 51 where the aliens were stored was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And they were stored there in the wreckage of all known UFO crashes. Certainly the Roswell crash started it all. Was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So if you ask somebody, what do you know about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base? They'll say, Wright-Patterson what? What is that? And they don't know the connection. So we thought that doing a book about Wright-Patterson, which is where the all foreign technology, certainly of an alien nature, was housed for at least 35 years after 1947, that should be known. We should bring that into the sunlight and give the history of it. And that's what we've done. That's what we've done in this book. We've gotten all the accounts that we could come up with relating to Wright-Patterson with regard to its historical contribution, if that's the right word, to its historical place in history regarding UFOs. And that's what we wanted to do. And we've had good feedback on it so far. The book came out in August of this year, and it's doing very well. And we've had some people give us feedback, mostly by email, that they like it even better than the our Witness to Roswell book, which was actually the top-selling UFO book in the world for 2 years after it came out. So we're sort of pleased with it. You know, you always hold your breath, you know, when you hatch something like a new book, or, you know, it's like in the old days on Broadway when they had a new play, the producers would hold their breath, you know, until they got the reviews the next day. And we're very pleased at the reception that it's gotten.
Well, I think this is the best book on Roswell I've ever read. Now, you note that the land on which Wright-Patterson Air Force Base has a great deal of history. This is the strength, one of the strengths of your book. You guys are damn good researchers.
Well,
and you also research the things that are really important and not just the minutia.
Right. We can't cover every detail of everything, and certainly Wright-Patterson has a rich history all of its own, aside from UFOs. It was founded, by the Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur Wright, in 1903 to develop further that flying machine of theirs. And along comes so they were, I think they were bicycle, they ran a bicycle shop or something there in Dayton. Of course, they had their first flight in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, but they were from Dayton, Ohio, and so they wanted to find a flat location to where they could develop their, put in a aircraft strip for takeoff and landing, and also to develop that flying machine of theirs. And there was a flat plane just north of Dayton, Ohio, that they took over. I'm sure they bought it. I don't think they just squatted down and say, okay, this is ours.
Yeah.
But they took it and started their business there, as far as they called it the Flying Training School, something like that. And along comes World War One. And the military likes that area, too. So they took over Wilbur Wright Field, and it's been in the hands of the military ever since 1917, when the military took it over for national security reasons to develop aircraft. And so...
What about this fella Patterson? Who is he?
Patterson was the right side of the field, that's Wright, is known from the Orville and Wilbur Wright. But the Patterson side of it, which is the eastern end of this Wright-Patterson, was a separate airfield named for a local pilot who was killed in a landing at that location. The strip had another name at the time, but he was Patterson. I forget his first name. Was a local Dayton, Ohio hero for his exploits in the development of aircraft, and most notably, he was a pilot, and he was killed in the line of duty. So they wanted to remember him, and so they named the eastern strip of the Wright-Patterson complex Patterson Field, and it remains today as Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. But there was Wright Field and Patterson Field. There was also another airstrip inside of Dayton, Ohio, called McCook Field, and they all had different functions. They worked together, though, in certain aspects. One location was big in supply and logistics, and the other one was big in aircraft development, research and development. And so they worked so often together that when the Air Force became a separate branch of the military rather than a subset of the Army in September of 1947, the Air Force became a separate branch of the military, U.S. Air Force, and not the Army Air Force. They decided at that time, well, let's call all these fields, like Roswell Army Air Field and Wright Field and Fort Worth Army Air Field, let's call them Air Force bases. So Wright Field and Patterson Field became Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Because they work so often together, they just combined the two under the one command, and it became Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. But they went through so many iterations and reiterations. I know when I was doing the research on that, my head started to hurt. You know, there were so many different names that they called them, so many different people involved. My head started to hurt. So I said, I got to simplify this. I can't cover every little nuance that happened along the dusty trail of history. So we tried to focus in on those things that were pertinent to the subject at hand, which was the secrecy that they employed regarding the UFO phenomenon, starting with the Roswell incident and carrying on to the present. And that's what we tried to achieve.
You know, it took, as you know, I've forgotten how long it took for many scientists and other people interested in flying to believe the Wright brothers. I think it was years. It was a couple of years or so. They got it up in the air, and many people just didn't believe it. It's just as bad as the situation with UFOs.
Right. Well, Bob, anything new, especially to scientists and academicians, anything new is really frowned upon. It's almost like it has to come up and hit them in the face for them to accept something. And this is the way science works. This is the way any subject works, let's say any academic subject. As you know, there's this British journal called Nature. And if you have any new theory, a stunning new paper or something, you want to get it in the British journal Nature. And but that doesn't guarantee you that your theory will be accepted. It does lend credence to the level of credibility your name has. But new theories, new ways of doing things, especially to the experts, are really, it's a rough go. It's a rough go. It's like the theory that the dinosaurs were wiped out by a comet or an asteroid. Well, to me, the evidence is certainly more than to be considered. To me, it's almost conclusive that that's what happened. But you have people now trying to chip away at that. Yes, maybe an asteroid did strike because we have this layer of iridium that is present 65 million years ago all around the Earth. Maybe there was an asteroid, but the dinosaurs were on the way out even then. They were on the way out before this asteroid struck. So it's really tough to develop new theories that especially scientific types have to swallow. I know just on the internet, Don Schmidt and I, we take a lot of grief. just because we haven't invested so much in investigating this one case. I get people that come up to me at conferences and say, why are you investigating a 60-year-old case? Why don't you go on to something new?
Yeah.
My goodness, you know, different strokes for different folks, right? Well, apparently they don't see it that way. But
well, as you know, on the internet, they've already come to their conclusions. It's about the sloppiest group of researchers I've ever had to deal with. I've done, just like you, I've done so many shows with the History Channel, National Geographic, Discovery, and Sci-Fi, and BBC, and I am just amazed at some of the other individuals that I have to debate over and over again, who really have not done the research at all. But they sound good, and they look good. And right now, we got to take our first break. But when we come back, why don't you do some studying up on when was the original Area 51 established? Do you think you can do that for us?
Oh, is that a question to me?
Yes, of course.
I'm sorry.
All right. You go ahead and study up on that. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Tom Carey. As a matter of fact, it's called Inside the Real Area 51, which we're going to touch on in just a few minutes. The Secret History of Wright-Patterson with Don Schmidt. New Page Books, RoswellInvestigator.com. RoswellInvestigator.com.
This is Dr. John Mack, author of Passport to the Cosmos, Human Transformation and Alien Encounters. You are listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Sure do miss that man, Dr. John Mack. My goodness gracious. Our guest is Tom Carey, co-author of Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson with Don Schmidt. New Page Books, RoswellInvestigator.com. Okay, Tom, when was the original Area 51 established and for what reason? What was its purpose?
Well, the Area 51 that everybody knows, that would be the one in Nevada, just the northwest of Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. That was established in 1955. The Lockheed Aircraft Corporation, most notably Kelly Johnson, famous for his Kelly Skunk Works, which developed cutting-edge aircraft. They were developing something known as the U-2 spy plane, and they wanted a location that was very, very remote. Of course, Dayton, Ohio, where Wright-Patterson is not remote. It's right in the, in Ohio, very populous state. The city of Dayton, very populous. So they wanted a remote location to develop this U-2 spy plane. Now, you remember, the first satellite was launched by the Russians in October of 1957, Sputnik. So this is before the era of spy satellites, which it came even later. We didn't have spy satellites to look over vast expanses of the Soviet Union. So we wanted to know, after World War II, which ended in 1945, and we knew that Russia was our adversary, even before the war was over, we wanted to know what the Russians were up to, because they had developed, they were very good at developing military technology. So Kelly Johnson came up with this idea of a, really what it was a jet-powered glider. And its main feature was that it could fly at high altitudes, say 70,000 feet, which was really up there. There were no missiles at the time that could reach it. So they located in an area of Nevada next to Groom Lake, which was northwest of Las Vegas, and it was known on the map. This was a regular schematic map of Nevada. It was known as Area 51, as opposed to Area 50, Area 49, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There was nothing special to the name other than it was a place on the Nevada map. So in 1955, construction started on a facility located at Area 51. It was super secret because it was developing super secret technology. Most notably, the first project was the U-2. And as you recall, I don't know how old you are, but maybe you recall that in May of 1960, there was an international incident that occurred where one of these spy planes of ours, the U-2, and nobody had ever heard of it. I remember when I read about this, U-2, what is that? Because, you know, as a kid, I knew all of the fighter planes and bombers, et cetera, from World War II and after that was in our inventory. But I never had heard of a U-2. What is this U-2? Well, President Eisenhower, when the Russians announced that they had shot one down, President Eisenhower said, oh, that was one of our weather research planes. That was a weather research plane. And not knowing that the Russians already had the pilot, Francis Gary Powers, in custody. Instead of committing suicide, Francis Gary Powers parachuted out when the missile struck. So Eisenhower really had to eat crow when the Russians trotted out Francis Gary Powers and put him on trial. And later on, Powers was exchanged, I think, for Rudolf Abel, a Russian spy that we had held in captivity. So they were, it was like a trade, you know, in the baseball trade, I'll give you, you know, so-and-so for so-and-so, and that's what they did. But that was the U-2, and nobody really was concerned about what is this U-2 and where did this come from? Well, it came from Area 51. Well, after that incident, we needed something that flew yet higher and faster than the U-2, and that was the SR-71. It started out as the Oxcart, but it became the name that everybody remembers, at least some of us, was the SR-71 Blackbird.
Yeah.
Flew higher and faster, and that was our next spy plane that overflew the Soviet Union. So that's how it got started. 1955, these programs were commissioned not by the Air Force, but by the CIA. The CIA was driving this. Well, later on, the Air Force actually took over the facility and developed, that's where our stealth technology was developed. And I guess we became aware of the stealth technology during the first Gulf War of early 1990s. I think it was like 91, when we had the B-2 stealth bomber all of a sudden flew into the picture. And then this wedge-looking fighter, the F-111 Nighthawk, was also stealth. And that came. Both of those came out of Area 51. Well, still, Area 51 was not known to the general public. And it wasn't until 1988 that Area 51 became attached to UFOs. Remember, like I said, if you ask somebody on the street, you ever hear of Area 51? Oh, yeah, that's where the aliens are.
Yeah.
It's not where, oh, that's where the U-2 came from or the stealth technology. It's, they know it from the UFO connection. And that occurred from a fellow by the name of Robert Lazar.
Yeah.
In 1988, Bob Lazar came forward. He was claimed to have been a physicist that had worked on back engineering alien technology. And by alien, we don't mean that it came from Mexico or some other country, but it came from off the planet. And that started the whole scenario, Area 51 is really about alien technology, and all these other things are covers for the aliens that were trying to re-engineer their technology there. So that's how it all started. it wasn't until the 90s that the U.S. government even admitted that there was a facility there.
Yes, right.
in Area 51. And that was because of a lawsuit that some former employees who had worked there brought against the U.S. government hazardous material. They were burning hazardous material at this facility, and just in open pits. They would pour gasoline on it and burn it, and a number of civilians came down with various illnesses, some of them fatal. And the lawsuit didn't achieve victory because President Clinton signed an order that the facility could not be sued. But they did admit finally that there was a facility there. They didn't name it, but they admitted that yes, there is a secret facility there. End of that lawsuit. Well, a week before our book Inside the Area 51 came out, the CIA finally admitted that yes, there is a facility at Area 51. They admitted everything except that there were aliens there. Mm-hmm. So so we've come that far. But they still haven't said that yes, we are back engineering or there's bodies stored or anything like that. But they've come right up to the doorstep of admitting that, but they haven't taken that final step yet.
Well, let's get to Wright-Patterson's relationship to the Roswell story.
The relationship to of Wright-Patterson was actually the die was cast during World War II when we were fighting the Germans and the Japanese. We would capture some of their aircraft, like the Messerschmitts and the Mitsubishis and stuff like that. Well, there was a hangar at Wright-Patterson, Hangar 23, where whenever we captured one of those, we shipped it to Wright-Pat to back engineer it to see what made it tick, what the ME-109s and the Japanese Zeros were excellent aircraft. We wanted to know what made them tick and how we could advance our own technology to defeat them in battle. And that was done in Hangar 23 at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So along comes the Roswell incident in 1947, where all this wreckage is recovered. Where are you going to take it? Well, there's only one facility in the country that can handle this, that can analyze it and back engineer it and do all those things that we used to do to the Axis fighters and bombers and things like that. And that was Hangar 23 at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So that's where the Roswell wreckage was shipped. We know that from witnesses who told us that's where it was shipped. And this is before we knew that there were already back engineering facilities there already in, you know, ready to go. We that was part of the study that we did for our book. We found that out. Also, the biological material that was recovered at Roswell, the dead bodies, the little dead bodies, and the one that was alive were shipped to Wright Field also. Now, the dead bodies, they had cold storage, advanced cold storage at Wright-Patterson, and that's where the bodies were kept until cryogenic technology came along later, and they were stored cryogenically. But we also know that the bodies went there from eyewitnesses. So we have a combination of the history of Wright-Patterson, what they were capable of, and eyewitness testimony that's where they went. And they remained at Wright-Patterson for about 35 years, after which they were shipped elsewhere, probably because it was becoming known that because people would keep asking, well, is there really a Hangar 18 at Wright-Patterson? Is that where the aliens are? And so they sort of said, okay, let's move them. And we believe they were taken to Area 51. We don't know if they're still there, but they may, some of the stuff may have been shipped to Utah. The Dugway Proving Grounds, there's a facility there, and we think that maybe at least the bodies may be in Dugway.
Well, you spent a lot of time going through trying to resolve the problem concerning Hangar 18.
Yes.
We don't have a lot of time to do this, but could you get what was really Hangar 18, so to speak?
Hangar 18 is really Building 18.
Yeah.
If you go to Wright-Patterson tomorrow, Bob, and say, where's Hangar 18? Can you take me to Hangar 18? They'll laugh at you and say, what a dope you are. There is no Hangar 18, and never was. And they would be correct, not the dope part, but that there was never a Hangar 18. It was Building 18, and they know what you're really asking about. You're asking about where the aliens were stored, and they won't tell you that. But it's a long story. We have a whole chapter in our book, how we uncover how this notion of Hangar 18 at the Wright-Patterson came about. It was really a misnomer. There really was a hangar there and a building that were connected underground where all this stuff was taken and stored. And if you ask about that, they won't tell you. But they're happy to answer the question about Hangar 18 because there never was one. But we go into detail. And actually, Bob, I didn't know, I wrote that chapter, and I didn't know the answer to that prior to this book. Doing the research, I'm satisfied that I came up with the notion of where this idea of a Hangar 18 got started. And it was with a Florida UFO fellow by the name of Professor Robert Spencer Carr in the early 1970s started talking about it. And that's a whole other story, but that's where it started.
Robert Spencer Carr.
Yes.
I think he called himself Dr. Robert Spencer Carr.
Yes, he called himself Dr., and he actually made that up. His son said he was only a high school graduate, but he was a ufologist, interested in ufology, and he was trying to resurrect the old Frank Scully behind the flying saucers story, which was the Aztec case. He was trying to resurrect that. And during his talk that he would give, he would talk about a Hangar 18 at Wright-Patterson where all this stuff was taken. And really what he was doing was his sources, I'm sure, talked about a Building 18. And somehow when he came to talk publicly, it somehow morphed into Hangar 18. And but Robert Spencer Carr was no doctor, and his son was sort of embarrassed about him. And he was given to flights of fancy, and I remember him. I was at a time I was heading up to go to graduate school in Toronto, and I remember this story. This fellow was out there talking about bodies at Hangar 18, and of course I was interested in UFOs then. And once I got to Canada, the story, there was no more to it, and it sort of faded from history, except the Hangar 18 part is still with us.
Well, he really made a mess of another field of research dealing with American symbols, especially the pyramid and the eye and the triangle. And the eye and the triangle, which he refers to as being satanic, et cetera, et cetera. So
unaware of that.
Sloppy researchers are sloppy in just about every area. You know, I mean, if they're going to slop up one, they're going to slop up the other. The internet is filled with this kind of stuff, and it's a very difficult thing to correct because you can't correct it because they know more than everybody else because they wrote the history themselves. So it doesn't make any difference. They're always right. We'll take our second and final break of this hour with Tom Carey inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson with Don Schmidt, New Page Books, RoswellInvestigator.com. Hey, by the way, we now know what's killing the bees, and if you think the pesticide companies are going to, fess up, you're wrong. They're not going to. They'll fight that one. How would you like to win a free copy of the book we are talking about, Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson by Thomas Carey and Donald Schmidt, published by New Page Books. at newpagebooks.com. If you know the answer to this hour's trivia question, you're going to win that book. Do you know who was my first guest on 21st Century Radio the last time I hosted 21st Century Radio? Tell us who my first guest was on 21st Century Radio the last time I hosted 21st Century Radio. And if you get that correct, then you're and right, you need to qualify. Here's how you qualify. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
This is Dr. Jacques Vallée. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus, the reference in the study of the paranormal.
I'm a reference. Hey, Dr. Jacques Vallée, thank you for that Christmas card. We have such a good time with that man. Great, extraordinary soul. Okay, our guest is Tom Carey, Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson, with Don Schmidt, New Page Books, RoswellInvestigator.com, and you can always find links to our guests and their books on 21st Century Radio Facebook page, or on the front page at 21stCenturyRadio.com. Oh, gosh, there are so many particular things that I want to talk about here, and the Blue Room. The Blue Room, I think we need to go into as soon as possible. I know Barry Goldwater tried many times, and I think you finally have resolved the real reason why he was not allowed to visit the Blue Room. I have never heard this reason before, and I'm so glad you did that. Tell us about the Blue Room at Wright-Patterson, which supposedly stores alien artifacts, etc.
Yes, Bob, the Blue Room was on, jumping to today, any Air Force base you go to today will have a Blue Room, and that's usually the room where the most secret things are housed, and usually it's the radar room in any Air Force base. But back in Goldwater's day, that was probably true, but not for Wright-Patterson, because the UFO subject was above top secret. It was beyond even the A-bomb back in, it probably still is. But the most secret room at Wright-Patterson, the Blue Room at Wright-Patterson, was where the alien artifacts were kept, including the biological materials. And Barry Goldwater himself was a UFO buff. He was always interested in UFOs. He was interested in Roswell. And he just happened to be a U.S. senator, well-respected on both sides of the aisle, which is sort of unlike today. He was respected on both sides of the aisle, Democratic and Republican. Well, he was a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and at some point became the chairman of the Armed Services Committee in the U.S. Senate. He was also a reserve Air Force Major General. That's two stars. So he wore two hats, sitting U.S. Senator. He was also a candidate, the Republican candidate for President of the United States in 1964, and he lost to Lyndon Johnson in the post John Kennedy landslide. Kennedy was assassinated in 63, and Johnson won by a landslide in 64 against Barry Goldwater. Well, the nearest I can figure it, it would have been about 1962-63. Goldwater finds himself at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base as a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, going over something, you know, checking on something that was of interest to that Senate committee. And he says, by golly, you know, I'm a friend of Curtis LeMay. Curtis LeMay at that point was the chief of staff of the U.S. Air Force, top position in the Air Force. Chief of Staff Curtis LeMay, 4 stars. Well, Goldwater, being a senator and also a general, you know, he was qualified if anybody was qualified to look in the blue room, it was Goldwater. Well, he says, I'm going to get a peek in there, that blue room, while I'm here. So he calls up LeMay, who's in the Pentagon. He says, General, there are rumors going around here you have a room here. He never referred to it as the blue room. He just referred to it as a room. You have a room here where all those alien artifacts are stored. At least that's the rumor. Can I have a look inside that room? And Goldwater, who told this story on television, said that LeMay just flew off the handle. Now, these two guys were friends. Imagine if they were not friends. But he said Goldwater cussed him up one side and down the other. No, you can't look in that room. Hell no, you can't get in there. I can't get in there. Well, I don't believe that. I believe the chief of staff, if LeMay couldn't get in there, then who could? So he says, you can't get in there, I can't get in there, and don't ever ask me that again. If you ever ask me that again, I'll see that you're court-martialed. Well, I'm sure glad his friendship kicked in there, because Goldwater wasn't court-martialed, but he never did get inside the blue room. And when asked, he said, well, I sort of stood down. I never brought up the subject again. Mm-hmm. We sort of wish he did, because maybe persistence would have gotten him in there, but he dropped it, and that was it as far as his attempt to get into the blue room. And that was, as near as I can date it, it would have been like 1963, plus or minus 1 year. So that was it.
But you also pointed out that he was told that no elected officials would ever be allowed to go in.
Yes. When the Roswell material was transported, and they after things had settled down, the government and the military decided, probably more the military than the government, that you had to have some sort of control over this, somebody or some organization that would exploit the technology, try to find out what made it tick and try to copy it, all those sorts of good things. And you needed someone to determine who had access to it and who didn't. Well, they decided, Stan Friedman calls it the Majestic 12, Arthur Exxon, who was the base commander in the mid-60s, called them the Unholy 13. Well, what was decided was that no political person would ever be allowed access to the Roswell or the UFO artifacts. And that was that. Probably still true, because presidents, Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, and Ronald Reagan, none of them had access to the artifacts or at the Blue Room at Wright-Patterson. If you remember, Bill Clinton, when he took office, he assigned one of his aides, Webster Hubble, two things. He says, I want you to find out two things. Who shot JFK, and are UFOs really real? And unfortunately for Clinton, Hubble was convicted of some crime that he had committed, overbilling or something. He was a lawyer when he was down in Arkansas, so he never did get to follow through on those projects that Clinton had given him. And if you remember Jimmy Carter, and I remember this.
Oh, yeah.
In 1976, in a U.S. News and World Report little piece, Carter, it said that Jimmy Carter was about to disclose unsettling comments about UFOs soon. Well, it never happened.
No, it didn't.
It never happened.
No.
He never got access to the UFO material. Mm-hmm. So the pledge of the original group never to allow a political person access to the material held, and it probably still holds today.
We got about 2 to 3 minutes of this hour left. Let's talk a little bit about General Arthur Exon, who happens to be one of my heroes.
Yes, Arthur Exon was a fighter pilot during World War II, and he stayed in the Air Force, became a logistics specialist, and in 1964-65, he became the base commander, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. In fact, he was there in 1947 when the Roswell material came in. And he was discovered, and I put that in quotes, by, the fellow who wrote Communion. And we did
Strieber.
A show a couple months ago.
Yeah, Whitley Strieber.
Whitley Strieber, good friend of mine. How's that for forgetting names? Whitley Strieber discovered him. It turns out Exxon was a friend of one of Strieber's uncles. So he contacted Arthur Exxon, who told him all about being at Wright-Patterson when the wreckage came in and then being the base commander. And even he was denied access. He did not have access to the UFO material or the bodies, but he had friends there, of course, being the base commander, who did have access. We're talking about medical people and scientific people that Exxon knew. And I know I visited Exxon with Don Schmidt about 10 years ago down in Irvine, Texas. And I'm sorry, Irvine, California. And his story was that, yes, he heard that the material, after all the analysis was done, the conclusion was that the pieces of wreckage had come from space, meaning that they were extraterrestrial.
We have to stop right there. We'll come back with Tom Carey when we return on 21st Century Radio. Again, the book is Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson with Don Schmidt, New Page Books. Also, we're going to get a chance to talk about the memory medal and some of the progress has been made. I mean, this book has got so much good stuff in it. We didn't even scratch the surface so far. We'll be back with Tom in just a few minutes.
Stimulating talk around the clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com. WCBM Baltimore.
Fox News Radio, I'm Jane Metzler. A new report.